Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me today for this week's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. Today we're going to be covering three recent news stories in our field of international education that hopefully will resonate with you, and hopefully I'll be able to share some of my insights on what's actually happening and how these particular topics are impacting our industry. So I would encourage you to stick with us for the next half hour or so as we cover the next 30 minutes. We'll talk about how these issues are really affecting institutions around the country and students certainly around the world that are considering the United States as a potential destination for their higher education studies. So thanks for getting online with me. And we'll get to the first topic in just a moment here. Again, these are weekly events that we are conducting here on SMIE Consulting's Facebook page. These Facebook chats are meant to just share my particular views on three issues each week that are gaining a lot of traction in the news, and perhaps one or two stories that might be a little bit offbeat, off the beaten path a bit, that you might not have heard of, but certainly are reflective of trends in our industry that certainly need some attention paid to them. So the first of our stories this week is USCIS, the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. That's part of the Department of Homeland Security. They have recently backtracked this past week on their previous claim that students that are in the United States on STEM OPT extensions are no longer able to work at third-party sites as part of their practical training experiences in terms of authorized work permission. So this was actually proposed back in May by a number of by USCIS after they made a number of other changes. And I'll be posting the links to these articles in the comments section here on the Facebook page. And this particular article in Forbes covers what actually happened with the rule change. It gives a little bit of the history too. There had previously been language introduced in May that aimed at preventing international students in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, OPT training, authorized training, from working for companies at third-party locations. The fear was that these students were not being properly supervised by their initial employer, which is very much a part of the STEM OPT extension that is employer specific. There's a work plan involved, and the thought was that, at least the rationale given by USCIS, that this was not proper STEM OPT work. But in reality, is a lot of the students that might have been going on these work experiences, working for a company at third-party locations, may be doing tech support for a company, and that might be very much a part of and in line with their training. So the USCIS article kind of details a lot of that. There was a lawsuit filed to prevent that change from becoming a reality in terms of this proposed restriction on third-party location work for OPT. So that the response was, well, maybe that's not the best thing that we give this new restriction would be put students potentially in the place that also falls in line with another USCIS change, part of a larger government push to more forcefully impose penalties for unlawful presence. This is a recent change that from the first day that a student or someone in F1 status would become unlawfully present by violating status, then a clock would start ticking that would prevent, if they accumulated a certain number of days, prevent them from re-entering the United States for a period of up to 10 years. So that was a very harsh. That is something that is being implemented, at least as far as we can tell right now. That's student, there's a, I think there's a public comment period open at this point, but this is a potentially devastating double whammy for STEM students that are on OPT if they are at third-party work sites, and then would have this, if this new rule hadn't taken effect on not being able to work at third-party sites, it could have led to them retroactively being out of status for 100 days or so, and then that could prevent them from re-entering the United States again next time they came for a visa appointment. So again, a very very interesting way that this this rule is being interpreted. One of many, frankly, changes that have been afoot at USCIS within the Department of Homeland Security. This also comes on the heels of a recent interview the USCIS chief gave to The Hill back in, I think, just this past month, or actually middle of this month, where the director of USCIS, Francis Cisna, had removed, earlier in the year, had removed the United States CIS mission being a part of it. The initial statement was that the United States secures America's promise as a nation of immigrants by providing accurate and useful information to our customers, granting immigration and citizenship benefits, promoting an awareness and understanding of citizenship, and ensuring the integrity of our immigration system. That was the previous mission statement of USCIS since its inception in 2002-2003. So this change, the new statement, basically removed that language, the nation of immigrants, language, which is very, very disheartening, frankly, for international educators, and for myself, being an immigrant. As a young child, I came over with my father and my mother and my brother, as on visas, L2. I was an L2. I was an intra-company transfer dependent, where my dad's company in England transferred him to the headquarters of that company here in the U.S. And that, as a young child growing up, I was an immigrant and became a citizen shortly before my 18th birthday. So that changing that language from USCIS is it really innocent in its change? Cisna's rationale was that there's a misunderstanding of what that meant over the years. That as USCIS, that their responsibility was to serve the people they interact with every day when they take applications or petitions. That he said that was the previous assumption of what it meant, but that's not, he says, that's not who we serve as USCIS. We serve the American people who have conferred upon the agency and mission through Congress to administer immigration law. So the language was changed to show a much more enforcement type language, that USCIS now administers the nation's lawful immigration system, safeguarding integrity and promise by efficiently and fairly adjudicating requests for immigration benefits while protecting Americans, securing the homeland, and honoring our values. So certainly some things in this change at USCIS, with that removal of nation of immigrants language, this proposed ban on third-party work site authorization for STEM OPT students, and then also, frankly, the unlawful presence enforcement that is going into place, which sounds like will be going into place. So I think that there's a lot going on here that's perhaps symptomatic of a larger government-wide concern related to immigration and all things immigration, whether that be undocumented students and dreamers to illegal immigrants who end up coming to this country and, as was the case in Iowa, end up murdering a young college student, to a variety of other student benefits, the international student visa students that have come to the United States. So there's a lot of concern, obviously, with the direction. Certainly many in the field have experienced since the election in terms of changes in the government structure and and mission, frankly, that seemed to be a little bit against what we would normally consider who we are as Americans, redefining, frankly, what we are, who we are as Americans. So that's certainly something something to pay particular attention to in the months to come, to see whether particularly the unlawful presence rule gets enforced. I think there's still a public comment period might be up just now, but certainly one to keep an eye on. Second story I'd like to cover today is a recent post out of Arizona on kind of the incoming classes of the two flagship institutions in the state, Arizona State University and University of Arizona. A particular piece in AZ Central, online news part of the USA Today network, that highlighted some of the challenges that the international student offices, recruitment offices at those two institutions have faced. Two very different styles of institutions in terms of what they the way they're set up internationally. I'll post the link to the article now in the comments section here. And this article is actually fairly well written in its what it does cover, but it makes the point on it has a couple of students that they've interviewed, on one from Saudi Arabia and a couple others as well, that are ones attending ASU, talking about their experiences and international enrollment looks like at ASU, which frankly I've seen as one that has their act together internationally. Certainly they have a very well organized system on the services side as well as the recruitment side, and are incorporating international alumni into their recruitment, have a fantastic orientation program, and really have the building blocks that have allowed it to succeed and grow for the past decade or so. Up until this last year, 2017, they did see a drop in new international student enrollments, first time in over a decade. But we're also seeing at Arizona, University of Arizona, where there were also declines over the last 2 years. They had a larger international student class, this freshman class this year, but overall we're still down. And the story does go into some of the things that I think a lot of institutions are suffering from these days. And for Arizona State, their two of their largest populations were Saudi Arabian and Kuwaiti students, and they saw a drop of only nine students from Saudi Arabia in the last year, which is actually remarkable considering the global drops or the global or nationwide drops that U.S. institutions have been experiencing with their Saudi populations. But where they saw the most significant drop was from, ironically, Kuwait, which had 699 students last year and only 600 this past year. So our most recent numbers, 600. So they lost over almost 100 students from Kuwait, but only 9 from Saudi Arabia. So that, I think, but that was counterbalanced. Those drops in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia were counterbalanced by increases from India of almost 100 students, and South Korea did see some drops from about 30 students or so. So there's been some interesting changes going on there. And again, they are a school that really looks at trying to diversify as much as possible their international population, and they are certainly one that has a fairly diverse representation in their student populations. So China did see a drop at ASU as well. So Arizona also, University of Arizona also had saw drops in four of their top five sending countries: China, India, Mexico, and South Korea. And at University of Arizona, ironically, Saudi Arabia was the one that did not decrease. So interesting to see schools in Arizona that have fairly large international populations starting to see the impacts of a number of different factors. And Christiana, thanks for getting on. I see Jim's also on, and John, thank you for getting online today. This Christiana's question, any expected potential exceptions to this? Saudi, for example, where we've modified the process based on Canada-Saudi issues. Let's see, Christiana, are you talking about the USCIS story, I think, or the Arizona story? If it's the USCIS, expected potential exceptions to this related to the STEM OPT issue, is that what you're asking about? If that's the case, I think, I don't know if the decisions that would impact are external factors that would impact STEM OPT are, I don't think what's happened in Canada. Yeah, that's a good question, if it's a loophole there or not. With the OPT piece, STEM OPT, I don't think that's obviously further on down the line for new students coming in that potentially would be coming in as part of the challenges here for Saudi students that might be looking to transfer to U.S. schools. We did see last week Portland State University in Oregon has decided to make exceptions to or to try and allow pathways for some of those Saudi students from Canada who might be looking to come to the U.S. to matriculate there in the fall. So other institutions are working that up. And Christiana, if you could be a little bit more specific about how that would tie, how I'm not sure I'm quite reading it, how that will tie for those Canadian Saudis in Canada now that might be looking to come to the U.S. As it relates to the USCIS story that we just covered. When we talk about how institutions on this Arizona story is kind of a symptomatic of a larger trend. In that article, there was also some fairly useful discussion from a bit broader perspective on what was going on with in the larger industries related to universities' recruitment of international students, and how many institutions across the country have seen declines if they overinvested in Brazil and Saudi Arabia as primary sources of their international student populations. Those two markets for the greater majority of U.S. institutions that have been active recruiting in those countries for the government scholarship programs, certainly those there's been a significant drop-off, curtailment of numbers of those Saudi students coming on government scholarships to non-top 200 universities, and that's global universities, not just U.S. universities. And also the further complication for those that were bringing in Brazilian students, and that was one of the schools, Arizona State certainly had significant numbers from Brazil that were part of their student population, so they certainly suffered from those drops from Brazil and Saudi Arabia. So there's a lot of good commentary on what the impact in China will be for institutions that have been recruiting there, because frankly, China, Middle East are going to be areas where Middle East certainly is certainly feeling a brunt on a couple different ways. You've got the Saudi drop off in scholarships. You've also got some interesting, obviously with the travel bans and the impact that's had, not that the intended impact as or the recognized impact of those travel bans has gone far beyond just the six or seven impacted countries. That is now being seen, particularly in the Muslim world, as very much a restriction or a seen as America kind of rolling up the welcome mat in some ways from a governmental level. I do like in this article the amount of attention that's paid to these kind of macro trends, and Peggy Blumenthal at IIE is quoted in this article heavily related to the representatives from Saudi Arabia, the impact of the Saudi Arabian government scholarship and how the impact of that would be quite widespread. And you'd also see that in Kuwait, there's some curtailment there. They are, in fact, Kuwait, the government scholarship in Kuwait, not as large as the Saudi one, but certainly the government of Kuwait closed the enrollment of new students at Arizona State because there were too many at that school. So there weren't There weren't as many opportunities. There weren't any opportunities for new Kuwaiti students that were government sponsored to go there. So that's unfortunate for them at Arizona State to and have that fairly large part of their incoming student population each year cut off. So down 100 almost in a year. So the discussion of the Trump effect is also covered in this article. And I think there's a piece of this that's been a kind of underlying trend in a lot of news stories that have come up post-electing as they relate to international education, in that it's all due to Trump that these things are happening, but it's not. It's a multiplier, and certainly the attitude that has been conveyed has multiplied some of the negative things that have happened. But a lot of this damage that's being happened is completely external from that Trump effect. When, for example, the Saudi government scholarship was made while President Obama was still in office. This Kuwaiti situation at ASU was very much a country-specific one. The Brazilian rollback on scientific mobility, that happened as a result of funding and the program had kind of run its course and was going into a new direction. So the political atmosphere certainly hasn't helped, but the realities are a lot of these issues were popping up, and for institutions that become too dependent on any one set or two or three countries as destination as sources of students, you see a lot of those situations really rearing their head as it relates to cumulative impact on what an institution's bottom line is in terms of international student recruitments. So, Christiana, thanks again for the comments here related to the immigration policy in general. I think that one might be a little bit unrelated to those two topics, but certainly that's a topic I did cover in my last week's episode related to what's happening in Canada and what that political flap has caused is causing in Canada. Again, that's certainly something we can cover again as that story develops. But you never know where that's going to go. Jim, great to have you on. Relaying the message to the higher ups at institutions and talking about the ebbs and flows of international numbers from various countries. And you, as you rightly point out, it is crucial now more than ever that institutions stay the course with their recruitment efforts, especially in terms of in-country recruitment. Absence for even a year can be detrimental to the flow of students, and absolutely true, Jim. And I know, having worked at institutions that have maybe set the bar too high in terms of international student populations, and not real in terms of bringing in new numbers, and or raising the numbers that were expected. The fact that institutions take a very short-term approach when they feel like, oh, well, all these things are lining up and kind of serving to prevent, kind of provide a real barrier for us moving forward, they kind of throw their hands and give up. And it's really kind of sad that when that happens, because it really shows a short-sightedness and a lack of real investment and concern for those students that are coming from abroad, because they end up being an institution's best ambassadors in the long run, if they have come and have positive experiences. And in the end, that's what every institution wants for any student that comes to their campus, is for them to have positive experiences. But when institutions don't play for the long game in international, and don't plan recruitment strategies that are recognizing the need to go back year after year to particular core markets, if they're looking to maintain and or expand the students that they're getting from particular countries, then I think those are the institutions that will suffer and continue to suffer and perhaps even close. If they have become so heavily dependent, certainly you're seeing institutions around the country closing majors. That's happening in Ohio, it's happening in other states around the country, where institutions are slashing their majors because they're not viable any longer to keep, and that some of that has to do with core curriculum, some of that has to do with capacity as in majors. A lot of it has to do with budgets that through faculty, through if there aren't students enrolled in those programs, what is the upkeep in, on those programs to maintain. You're going to see that, I think, a lot more in the years to come with graduate programs that are particularly invested in international students or reliant on international students. I should say not invested in, but reliant on. Those are too reliant on international students. There are graduate STEM programs around the country, variety of MBA programs around the country that are suffering because of the drops in international students that might be coming to their programs. And in some departments, you might have 70% of students being international in some of these STEM engineering and science programs. So those, if those departments close, what's that going to mean? Because they were funded primarily through the tuition dollars of international students. If that happens, what does that mean for institutions in general on a wider scale? And I want to close today with a story that's kind of a smaller story, but one that kind of got my attention this past week, and it's actually out of an international journal for science called Nature. And it's a story about Iranian students that are protesting the U.S. visa slowdown. And these are students who have been admitted to graduate programs in sciences, mostly sciences, technology, engineering, management, mathematics programs, STEM programs. These are students that have filed a petition to call for the U.S. government to reverse an apparent decline in visas granted to Iranian scholars, students and scholars. So we all know about the travel bans and that Iran and six other Muslim majority countries were initially on that travel ban in January 2017 that did bar citizens from those countries from entering the United States. That there's been a couple of changes to that travel ban, and the one that was recently upheld, the third version that was held, does still restrict citizens from seven countries, not the same seven, but includes Iran from travel to the U.S. They do have, and what often never gets reported in the press is that these bans have exemptions for students who would be coming to the U.S. to do pursue degree studies or scholarly research, whatever it might be, but that they were very few, in fact, significant drops in the monthly in the number of visas that were granted that of two citizens of those travel ban countries. Iran certainly is the one that stood out as a prominent sender of students to the United States. They are still a top 11 as of last year's Open Doors sender of students to the United States, with over 12,000 students in the United States studying at U.S. institutions as of last year. The visas granted have steadily dropped since actually 2015. So this is pre-election, pre-travel bans. So there's been a real a slowdown in the number of visas issued to Iranian students in particular. So not a prohibition, but it's certainly a slowdown. And there are some interesting stories here students that were an Iranian student who was looking to begin a PhD program in computer engineering this year. He was originally admitted for studies for August 2017. And as a result, when he first applied for his visa back in May 2017, he quit his job, thinking that it would be approved quickly and be able to start in the United States. Now he's been waiting for over a year, still hasn't had a decision on his visa. So it's really a kind of heartbreaking situation for students that are in these situations, and I think it's symptomatic of their feeling as students that they're not being welcomed here, that the ball has, or the game has certainly changed for them, even though delays in visa processing that we're seeing now for students from these seven countries, Iran in particular, certainly harkens back, maybe even worse than some of the worst days after 9/11, when some of the Mantis and security clearance hurdles that the visa applicants were having to go through at that time of 2002 to 2006 or so. when those were significant roadblocks to students from Muslim-majority countries coming. I think that's where we've seen, for particularly in Iran's case, students from Iran, but perhaps other countries from the Muslim world. I think you're seeing some of those the lengths of time for visa processing even eclipse what was happening post 9/11. So something to keep on the radar, and one of those many issues that perhaps will get no press, but certainly ones that I think are worth keeping an eye on as things develop. So not wanting to end on a downer this week, but that's certainly a story that kind of tugs at the heartstrings a bit in terms of what those students who still, despite all the rhetoric, but despite all the issues that are happening politically in this country, they still want to be here. They still recognize the value of a U.S. higher education, and that's something that I think hopefully never goes away. Hopefully the government realizes that we should be putting up fewer roadblocks to these students rather than more, and I think that's where I would want to leave it today. So thanks again for joining me today, and I look forward to hearing from you again next week. Again, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, we'll be doing this until I can't do it anymore. So thanks very much for joining me today, and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.